So welcome back to Pax Europiana, to my podcast about European peace. And in this section, we discuss about EU days. And this one now is for the 2nd of February to be the EU day for FIMACO. Now you will ask me, Günther, what is FIMACO? Now, yeah, I think FIMACO is a short term which every European and everybody interested in politics and history should know, because it is the key to understand a lot of issues we have today. FIMACO is a financial vehicle, basically, and it's a huge scandal. It's a holding company registered in the United States, and it was registered in the year 1990, basically to transform Soviet Union external financial assets into private property of the few who control it. So that's basically the concept. Imagine, again, I want to lead you back to this year 1990. Nobody knew that the Soviet Union will break apart. That was only end of 91. But obviously the empire of the Soviet Union in Central Europe, Eastern Germany, Bulgaria, all these countries, there was revolution after revolution. See the world from the Soviet Union perspective. These were hammer blows, boom, boom, boom. Eastern Germany gone after 40 years, yeah. Romania in revolution, and Ceausescu dead, you know, tuck, 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 they were hammered. And obviously they understood that times are changing, and who knows what was the future for the Soviet Union. So the elite of a communist country, you don't have to explain that the means of production are very important. I mean, that's the philosophy of communism, that you should control them, yeah? That the workers should control, or the representative of the workers should control the means of production. So obviously, they were thinking, they are very smart people as well there, and they were thinking how to control the means of production. So what they did is that the Soviet Union itself had already quite a lot of assets. It was a big empire. It has alone the Soviet Union had 280 million of people and their products, but also the natural resources, the oil, the uranium, the weapons industry. This is all a lot if it controlled it by a few. It was obviously not enough for all of the people of the Soviet Union because it was basically bankrupt. But for a few, it's quite a lot. So they thought, let's try to shift these assets, which are already abroad, first of all, foreign property, foreign asset holding, some secret companies, and also the accounts which are used to buy something, because you cannot live in complete autarky. You have to do operations abroad, you have to buy some materials, and so they had accounts out there. So they were basically trying to privatize this in a sense to steal it, obviously, because this was not a privatization process under some kind of transparency and a tender, but they basically, the station managers out there, or in some ways, and that's FIMACO basically, also the elite of the Soviet Union itself, they saw also the rise of Yeltsin as a competing power source inside Russia. They were not sure what will happen with the Federation property outside, and they basically decided to control it. Some of them might have thought it's their right to defend the Soviet idea. They thought for a later return of the Soviet Union, it is very important to have financial control. Some of them thought they have worked hard their whole life and then everything should be lost. No, I take it. Some of them were simply thieves. Some of them thought it's completely legitimate and much better than it will be used by some capitalistic Russian successor state, or somebody were simply only financially motivated. Yeah. So basically, FIMACO was that one holding. There were a lot of this, you know. I'm sure there were many, many of these kind of processes going on in 1990 all over Eastern Europe. Yeah. But what is happening is the FIMACO is the most famous. And why should everybody know it? Because it has a huge political implication. It has this implication because on the 2nd of February 1999, this scandal broke in the Russian public and it had huge repercussions, which I will discuss here now. And I think it's quite important that they are absolutely vital to understand the rise of Putin, but also they are very important in European economic history. And so let's discuss this whole process. But let's first understand Soviet Union falling apart. There is many assets and few control it, and they try to run away with it. When you see all this Russian investment, how it really started, this is one important source, taking basically the assets of the Soviet Union, which were already parked in New York or in Washington or in London or in Vienna. They were basically then, in a way, stolen by the persons who had the physical control of them. And they thought, anyhow, the empire is gone, let's take it. And this is the route number one. The route number two, obviously, is also very important, is then there was this amazing and positive phase of for the world, but unfortunately it failed, of Igor Gaidar's privatization. But what happened, he had only 1 year, because the resistance in the parliament in the Russian Federation was, of course, much too high for reforms, and that anyhow led also to this violent clash, to a kind of civil war in Russia in September 1993. You might remember there was first a coup in 1991, where Yeltsin ultimately got power, could establish Russia, Gorbachev was gone, this kind of counter-coup was defeated, and then in September 1993, Yeltsin basically military fighting with the Russian parliament, it sounds really nice, but it was basically the old nomenklatura, and they battled it out in the streets of Moscow, and Yeltsin won, Gaidar won, but it was not such a convincing victory. It was a kind of a compromise victory, ultimately, and it led also then, obviously, this was the timeline, 96, and the whole issues about the re-election of Yeltsin and the threat that the same kind of nomenklatura, which was militarily defeated in 93, might electorally win with Zhuganov and the communists in 96 again. That was the threat. Let me explain a little bit about this process of privatization, because it is very good to privatize, and it was really good. But the problem in a transition country to privatize was the problem that you had this coupon idea, and that was very good. The workers and the citizens got more or less a lot of shares of these big companies for free, or part of the salary. But obviously then the problem is they had no money and they didn't want to be investors in that sense. So they were selling it all at once, and obviously nobody had money to buy. So they were very, very low evaluation. So then the only ones who had money to buy were these people who stole the asset of the Soviet Union outside, or they were the directors in the companies, in the Soviet companies already. These were the same guys who were in charge of in the 80s, and they also were in charge in the 90s, because they were simply the competent managers and they continued, but they were also in control of everything which was movable and sellable. That means, for example, if you are the manager, you cannot buy the company so easily, but you can control the petrol, you can control the mineral wealth on this company, you can control the salaries in a sense. So they were the ones who were squeezing the system they owned, selling things, had cash, and they were buying back then the shares. And so, because the workers who had the shares were interested in money, not in shares, so this nice, well-meant privatization led to the managers, basically, the red directors. It's their own caste of people, also all over the Soviet Union, ex-Soviet Union, which are owning big industrial assets. They are now approaching the 60s and 70s. They were in that time in the 30s and 40s, and they have gained these companies via that process, which you can say it's not perfect. Some of them was all obviously fraudulent and based on theft. But, you know, there was a form from privatization. It was not too bad, in fact. In principle, it's always very messy to privatize such a big country like the Soviet Union and trying to somehow get private market economy going. But the problem was also in the context of the civil war and of the power vacuum of President Yeltsin, which was physically already quite ill and had all these problematic stints of alcoholism. Then obviously the whole system was very insecure. It was very much in the core of the power. It was very insecure. So Then, obviously, Gernot Mürden, he was the ultimate red director. He became, after Gaetan, the prime minister. And then we are heading already in the next issue of the pending 96 elections and the potential return of the same communist and nomenklatura elite, which was defeated militarily, basically, in 93. So 96 might go totally wrong. What was this Yeltsin administration and the team around it thinking then? Obviously, they had to mobilize a lot of resources in order to win this major campaign. And then they crafted this idea of the big assets to be handed over. I'm talking about the so-called loans for shares scheme. That means the whole the big conglomerates, which were still in state ownership, they were then in a way not privatized, but they were in a way leased to certain individual oligarchs and their families who were interested, or business groups, and on a loan basis. So the equity was not transferred, but it was basically binding them very much into the second term of Yeltsin, because Zhuganov would have certainly not done something like this. So they raised a lot of money with it, with promising of future privatizations. That's basically how you can say that. They gave purchase options on big conglomerates. And again, it's useful to understand what I'm talking, because the Soviet Union has this huge landmass, and also the Russia has two-thirds of the Soviet Union Russia has inherited. And there are huge industrial complexes on these places, mainly built already in the 30s in the anticipation of the Second World War, to build all these huge tank factories, aluminium factories, and for the airline industry. I'm talking about huge industrial assets of global significance, mainly in Siberia or elsewhere in the East, based on all this mineral wealth which Russia obviously has. So we are talking about this. Then was shares for loans. That was basically buying all the political, economic elite of the country into a second term and financing basically on some kind of futures, if you want to say, this kind of elite into funding the campaign effort of Yeltsin, who by then was already quite unpopular, but he was managing to win in 96. And then, because the Yeltsin clan or Yeltsin family, if you want to put it, they had to make coalitions with various groups of the whole society, which were ready to support them, to buy them into the second term. And this security apparatus was also one of the compromises they made. Not the main one, the main was with the oligarchs, but they also had these former stakeholders, basically the more business-oriented former security service, because the more ideological-oriented former security services, they were on Zhuganov's side. And the more business-oriented, and here Yeltsin is one of, and now Putin is one of them, they were obviously then interested in this kind of milking the system, and they were put as one part of the coalition later in charge of the spoils. And here comes the spoils system, one for the, not for the oligarchs, but more for the security apparatus pro-Yeltsin. This was the state administration of the property system. And any country has a lot of property, and that's why they're called lands. Land is very much about countries. And then you have very often the case that you have a central property administration. In Austria we have it, and many other countries do as well. This is basically where the universities are owned, or the ministry buildings are owned, or some kind of the streets might be owned by that one. That is very different in old countries. But more or less, it's one state property fund. Yeah? But obviously, in the, if I'm talking about the ex-Soviet Union, where everything was owned by the state, and just a few things were privatized in the meantime. So the state property fund, it sounds always a little bit like a small thing, because it's quite a boring activity to run a state property fund, you know, some forests, some mountains, some lakes, yeah, whatever. But in the ex-Soviet Union, in Russia of 96, that was, of course, a huge activity, yeah, with a huge holding in the former communist countries, with a global property empire, with so many industrial assets and so much land attached, whatever, it was huge. And Putin, coming from Petersburg, where he was losing his job because of the loss of the elections of his political mentor. Then he came, Sovchak, and then he came to Moscow to be in charge of that one. Obviously, you know, that was a bonanza for him. He was an expert for exploiting the state property system, so he became the expert in the perfect position and the most powerful property holding maybe of the whole world. And this was what he did for 2 years. And then he became the CEO of the security service, where he basically came from. And here it crosses again with this Fimaco, and you will be surprised how that actually went. Yeah? Because Russia was in this kind of power struggle between people who really wanted to have a real country, and country, of course the communists wanted to draw back the time, but there were also people who were just trying to do, you know, the decent job. That was basically the idea. There was also this kind of people, and they knew also what was right and wrong. I think that's quite a universal situation. And there was this Russian general prosecutor, Mr. Suratov. Yeah? And so he is quite famous, and here we come to where all this Fimaco story and all this Putin story and all this Yeltsin story really crosses very much and comes to the decisive year of 99. And, you know, 99 was very decisive, not only for the Chechenian war, the second one, the Kosovo war, but for the rise of Putin to power. And how it started is this famous story, because in February, on the 2nd of February 99, this Fimaco scandal was disposed or put to the public by the Russian prosecutor, and it was shaking the fundament. Shaking the fundament, why? Not only the stealing of all this state property from 1990, but the same structures were also used in the so-called, it's called Kremlin Gate. Kremlin Gate is an important term as well, and this goes back to this 98 crisis. 98, it was the ruble devaluation, inflation crisis, a massive drop in August, I think on the 17th of August, 98. The ruble crisis. I was actually myself there on some political excursion to Petersburg, and it was dramatic. And I remember my good friend Fyodor, he was then going in a job and buying free television sets just to store value because the ruble was on the way down. It was dramatic. But why it happened? Obviously, it happened because the expectations of 96 re-elections were not met. And obviously they were insofar met that a lot of the system, which was betting on a victory of Yeltsin, and they were betting it for commercial reasons, not for ideological reasons. They had defeated Zhuganov. That was very good. The world was saved from a Soviet return. But it was obviously they wanted their payback time. And, you know, the oligarchs wanted to have these companies they had leased, yeah, and they got it. And the money-oriented security apparatus expressed by Putin, they exploited this property system, and they exploited it hugely. And, you know, nobody was interested in keeping the budget discipline or keeping some kind of decency in the management of the state. Yeltsin got, of course, even more sicker, and everybody knew in 2000 he cannot run a third time, and what will happen? Of course, you know, all of the interests who were now getting so rich with this kind of reimbursement after 96, they were then thinking, oh, what will happen after 2000? They needed a crystallization point to somehow secure their holdings. Because there is no rule of law, everything is flexible, so you need to have a power center which is securing the security and court and judiciary not to pursue and prosecute the past theft. And so it came. And it has to be mentioned as well, what is the Kremlin gate, not that I forget. In 98, obviously, then when a currency breaks and the country is in bankruptcy, whatever the reason, obviously the IMF is there to help. And so the IMF did. The International Monetary Fund transferred several billions to New York banks, which were then supposed to transfer this money to Moscow in order to stabilize the state funding. But as it seems, they didn't. Yeah? And what happened is that significant parts of this IMF money was then used basically immediately to evaporate in Swiss and other bank accounts. And there is this famous case of this banker Safra, who seemingly then was cooperating with the FBI and later died prematurely. And so the case was that this Kremlin gate was a huge theft operation of Western European, Western American taxpayers' money directly into the pockets of the system close to this FIMACO. And that, obviously, that was in 98. I'm talking now about August 98, yeah? And then in all this also, you know, the IMF complaint, people knew, people started to say what is really going on. You cannot steal directly the money which is sent to stabilize the country. And so they went obviously to the prosecutor general, that's like the attorney general, the biggest, the most important law enforcement person in Russia, a very important, powerful position. And he disclosed this scandal on the 2nd of February 1999. And then came all these spectacular things, which you might remember, where there was a real power struggle again, who can dismiss him and what is happening. And then Putin came up with this idea to discredit him. And in March 99, they put a video on where he was with two ladies in the one hotel room. It was not very visible if it was him or not. And whatever kind of operation that was, it was never very clear, because he was then in screened on state television in best time to have his adventures with two unknown young ladies. Yeah, and so, you know, it was certainly, sorry, it was certainly not very pleasant to be in this kind of television exposure, and it was quite a terrible thing. And this led to a power fight between him and his supporters in the National Assembly, in the Duma, in the Parliament, but he was discredited and he ultimately resigned. He then ran again in 2000 as a presidential candidate, but he didn't have any kind of significant support, and so he faded away in oblivion in a way. And I think it's very important to never forget this FIMACO, because it's a really telling scandal how everything happened, and basically also the methods of Putin. And he was then with this kind of operation to get this general prosecutor fired, to discredit him in the public as a morally corrupt person, to show him in television, to discredit him politically. I think he was then in the heart of the Yeltsin family, the defender of the system, in a sense. Yeah, and this was endearing him so much that he was basically then integrated and a candidate for the top leadership. He became in the summer 99 then the prime minister, and then all this operation with the apartment bombing and the second Chechenian war and the presidential nomination in the beginning of 2000, and his real victory then in the 2000 elections, this happened in this cadence of things. Additionally, it's maybe interesting to mention also the Mabitec scandal. It has a little bit of Swiss and a little bit of Kosovo relation, and it was one of these corruption schemes for the rebuilding of the property empire and the Kremlin. Obviously, that was in the bigger things. It was by far not about billions of corruptions, but about millions. But it had got also some prominence, and I would like to mention it. But the name, I think, is the most important for every European or every of the few listeners you are here will join. It's FIMACO. Remember FIMACO. Understand the stealing of Soviet property in 1990. The same structures also used then already in 98 to scheme up to steal the parts of this IMF loan and the big scandal, and how Putin and also Yeltsin at that time, well, he was already quite old, and I'm not sure he was in charge in that sense, because Yeltsin in many ways is also a positive historic figure, however complicated it was. He was bringing down the Soviet Union. And obviously some of these forces around him didn't forgive him for that. But nevertheless, it was possible. It's important to understand the FIMACO scandal in order to understand the rise of Putin towards power, and also the transformation of Soviet property in the US, in the UK, into, in a way, legal assets. And also the origin of this huge money crisis, money laundering scandal and system which we have in the European Union, in the UK, in Canada, and in the US, because in many ways we are very complicit with the system, because it was our banks who helped with them, our banks in Switzerland, in America, in the EU, in Germany, in Austria, in Cyprus, which were really thinking, oh, that's a heaven sent. Send us your billions, all over it's maybe a trillion of Russian property, Russian money in Western banks, or even more, I don't know. Because obviously what happened to much of this money, they always knew that it's very insecure, and this kind of privatization is not a firm legal basis, neither the voucher nor the loan for shares. It was also that obviously they knew when they were stealing, they are smart people. And they knew it's better to have this asset somewhere safe in a jurisdiction where the access is not so much depending on who is in power in the Duma or in the Russian government, and to have really some confiscation in a Western system. You have at least lawyers to defend you, which you really don't have in Russia. So a lot of these transfers were brought to Western Europe and to America, and all this Russian property miracle has started from whatever, Norway to Greece and Cyprus and all over New York, obviously. And then also these massive opportunities have arisen for the Western property sector and financial sector to be complicit in the money laundering schemes of the spoils of the end of the Soviet Union. And that's, I think, something we at least should know. We should also be serious towards the Russian middle class and the people of Navalny, that we are sorry about it. It happened now 30 years, but it's time to end it. It's time to clean it up. It's time to get real. And it's time also to give some of it back and investigate who are the real owners. And if it's in reality the Russian state, or then at least then give it someone day. There will be the time coming when there will be a serious Russian government again, a market-oriented Russian government, maybe led by Navalny or somebody else. Maybe it will take 5 years or 10 years or 15 years. But this kind of post-Soviet kleptocracy will not continue forever. And then it's also important to clean up this mess of Fimaco. And I think every European should know that part of our success the last 30 years is also the complicity in this gigantic theft of the century, when the post-Soviet elites have basically transferred and stolen everything, not everything, but the significant parts of the national wealth. And I think it is important to make a clear cut and say, at least in the past it was like that, but we want no longer to be complicit in these money laundering schemes of Russia and in this capital flight, whatever you call it politely, but it's a gigantic theft enterprise, and we should be stopping to be involved, yeah, and clean up this mess of Fimaco. And at least we should know and understand that it was exactly as I said. Maybe I missed some of the aspects. I'm thinking in my notes if I have forgotten something, but I think it was like this: Fimaco, the theft of the Soviet property abroad, yeah, then the first wave of privatization, the loan for shares in 96, yeah, and then the massive theft which led to the 98 collapse, yeah, and then the IMF ruble collapse and theft via Switzerland, and then 99 the disclosure of all this, and then the fight back against this disclosure and Putin's rise to power. And then you can continue also the story how Putin then, obviously he knew all that, and he was basically the winner against these various power groups competing, and he then consolidated the power back to his group of winning, competing interests, and he basically then took back the Yugos and other energy assets, which were then part of this deal with Yeltsin on the loan of loans for shares. And he basically nationalized it then back. And since then, he has consolidated the grip of the energy sector and of many of the other state property and mining sectors two friends of him who were basically sharing with him or part of his ownership or at least loyal to him and do not challenge his grip on power. And that's why he became also so extremely rich, as you can see in Navalny videos. And basically, that's the system seen up to today. And I hope it will not continue, but it requires also the Europeans, Americans and British and the Canadians and also others, but mainly the four jurisdictions to clean up this financial mess, which is left by the Soviet Union, to understand what happens and to investigate and not continue it. That's what FIMACO is about. And that's why we should have an EU day every 2nd of February. Think about the courage of this prosecutor to disclose all this. It's all on the internet, many books written about it. You can read in 15 different books about it, and it's also on Wikipedia. But it's basically the story. And he is now in disgrace, this Suratov, and he has tried to expose at least some of these dealings. And thanks for him, we know it. And it's quite good that we think one day a year about his courage to disclose the theft of the century. So think about him, think about FIMACO, and let the name FIMACO live in infamy forever. Thanks for listening. Bye.